Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. If you want to keep up on our most recent podcast, you can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about American Vandal. Before that was Midnight Run. Before that was Mother. Before that was Capote. And a real left turn before that was Con Air. So, themacguffinmen.com. You can follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen. Our next episode, next week's episode, will be about Blade Runner 2049. And then following that, we'll be talking about Poltergeist. And then after that, Double Indemnity. You can check those out in the coming weeks. But now we have a joint subcommittee meeting at the 50 yard line. So, we got to get through the theme song to that.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yeah.
We are here.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that list of movies. I think those are all left turns right back into each other where Con Air flows seamlessly into American Vandal.
That's a good point. I did actually forget about American Vandal because American Vandal was the all-time left turn and that we did not plan to do that episode.
Until
I was drinking one night and was like, hey, we should do an episode on this movie.
And like all drunk decisions.
Like all drunk decisions, it was a 10 out of 10.
But that's not what we're talking about today.
No, we did that already. We're over it. American Vandal is dead.
We're talking about two movies in which plenty of drunk decisions are made.
Yes. Actually, I wouldn't say there are a ton of decisions made, but there's a lot of drunk. Yeah.
I
think there's just like a lot of drunk wafting happening.
Yeah, Linklater doesn't do decisions.
No, he's not a decisions guy.
Life experiences flowing into each other.
Yeah, despite
for
the
2 hours.
Despite the fact that the definition of his job is just constant decision making, he doesn't do a lot of decisions.
Right. So we're talking about Everybody Wants Some and Dazed and Confused. One being the first being a spiritual sequel to the second. As we said,
I mean, you kind of said that in the most confusing way possible, just by switching the order of the movies. We're just so baked. Dazed and Confused. I mean, I would imagine anybody listening to this podcast knows Dazed and Confused came out in the 90s and Everybody Wants Some came out last year, but just for clarity's sake, you know?
Yeah. And one takes place in the 70s, one takes place in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And yeah, loose sequel. I mean, spiritual sequel says that. It's also, I'm reading a bit of a sequel to Boyhood. Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah, just in a very sort of, I think what probably happened is that Richard Linklater got to the end of Boyhood and was like, man, this movie has to be done because it's 2.5 hours long. And I've been working on it for 12 years or 14 years or however long they worked on that for. But I also kind of want to do the next scene, you know? And I mean, not that I forget what Eller Coltrane's name in Boyhood was. Mason. Not that Mason's experience would necessarily be the same as Jake's, because it very much wouldn't be. But just sort of that feeling of your first weekend in college sort of thing.
Yeah, and meeting a girl and meeting your roommates, which is where you leave Mason at the end of Boyhood, right?
Yeah, exactly. But despite what Linklater says, it makes way more sense to watch Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some back-to-back than it does Boyhood and Everybody Wants Some, you know? And that's not to put down any of those three movies, all of which I'm a big fan of. I just think Dazed and Confused just flows into Everybody Wants Some. The Dazed and Confused ends with people driving off into the distance, and the beginning of Everybody Wants Some is Jake driving into his new home, you know? They just pair together perfectly, so.
Yeah, and I think Boyhood being the most recent one that people respected, it was kind of a way to say this might be something you're interested in if you like Boyhood, even though they are much more different than Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some are.
Absolutely, and also, it should be pointed out, or Everybody Wants Some is Richard Linklater's Inception or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You know, that type of movie I'm obsessed with, where directors coming off their biggest success ever, in Richard Linklater's case, Boyhood, in the case of Christopher Nolan was The Dark Knight, so we got to make Inception. David Fincher, for some reason, wanted to make The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo after The Social Network. And Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master is another good example of that, after There Will Be Blood, where a director is able to get a project they may or may not have been wanting to do for some time and never just quite had enough clout to get it going, despite the fact that Richard Linklater was a name before Boyhood, you know, in film circles. It's just sort of like his career suddenly got to a point where his movie was literally winning Oscars. So, so he was able to get $10 million to make the movie that he'd wanted to make for 10 years, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And as you said, I mean, kind of known within film circles, and Dazed Confused obviously has a cult following, but was never really a boffo box office director, if you will.
No, of course not. Yeah.
So I guess we'll start with Dazed Confused.
Yes, that makes sense.
You said you're a big fan of all those movies.
Yes.
Okay. What's your history with Dazed Confused?
I think the first time I saw it was probably 19 or 20. And wasn't crazy about it. And I have found that every single time I've watched it, I like it better than I liked it the time before. And when I watched it on Saturday for the first time researching this podcast, I had a great time. When I watched it again yesterday, again researching this podcast, I somehow had a better time. It was fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah. So I do not have the older brother passing around the VHS sort of history with this movie that a lot of my friends did. A lot of people our age did. I didn't see it until I was sort of, as somebody without an older brother or older sister, there was nobody to pass me that VHS tape. So I'm less Mitch than Mitch's older sister, you know? And so I just never had that experience with it. But the older I've gotten, the more fun the movie has become, it seems.
And do you know why that is?
No idea. And also, I should point out that I just read a thing Chuck Klosterman wrote about Dazed and Confused, his Criterion essay about it. And it's like, I am a huge Chuck Klosterman fan, even bigger Chuck Klosterman fan than I am a Richard Linklater fan. And it's amazing. And I had never read that essay. And it's amazing how accurately his feeling about Richard Linklater describes how I feel about Richard Linklater. And that it's just sort of like it captures a feeling of being in high school better than it does an actual time period. Yeah.
The 70s.
Yeah, exactly. Like that Dazed and Confused can't accurately represent what it would have felt like to live in the 70s, because nothing really can, but it can adequately represent how Richard Linklater felt about living in the 70s as an adult, you know?
Okay. Yeah. And so is it the kind of meandering slice of life angle that this movie takes that allows you to appreciate as much as you do?
Yeah, that's part of it. It's also, again, like, all of Richard Linklater's movies to me have gotten better as I've gotten older. I mean, I've written about how Before Sunrise didn't do much for me when I saw it when I was 18, but when I watched it when I was 25, I was like, oh, this is now amazing. Whereas Before Sunset kind of was always a hit in my eyes. But I don't know. There's just something about the passage of time that that Richard Linklater is always able to capture in a very interesting way. And I think I was probably just too close to my own high school years when I first watched Dazed and Confused. And the older you get, the less high school, I don't know, or the more high school fades from your memory, and it just sort of becomes a feeling more than actual memories. And that's something, I mean, at the age I am now, I'm in my early 30s, like, it's really starting to fade now. And so I think that sort of helps me further appreciate the movie even more than I would have at the time, when at the time I would have probably just enjoyed it as a comedy and just wanted more McConaughey scenes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he is the takeaway. I mean, he's the thing that most people remember this. He is still so funny in this.
Oh, like, my God.
I saw this movie at a younger age than you were when you saw it the first time. And, you know, having seen it several times and how kind of overexposed that character is and knowing what you're getting into with him, I was surprised by how immediately funny I found
him. It's pretty amazing. And he's like, it's just, he's undeniable. And almost every one of his lines in this movie has become like quotable over the years, and like was at the time, presumably, to the people that saw the movie. But like, I think the only line of his that makes me laugh that I have never heard anybody quote is like right towards the end when they're about to drive to the football field, and he says something like, "Watch the leather," and laughs, like, because he's so wasted in that scene. I don't know, that's like the only one of his lines that seems to not have been quoted in my direction a number of times. You have older siblings. Were they the impetus of you seeing this movie?
No, I don't think they were. These were other friends, older brothers, still older brothers, still the way that you could safely assume. I saw it when I was probably 13 or something, and I kind of just assumed I was too young to get it because, you know, parts were good and, you know, I guess we should point out, I imagine it would come up anyway, but the soundtracks of these movies are, especially Dazed and Confused, are kind of all-time soundtracks and just a summation of a decade in music. Dazed and Confused does a great job for the time period it tries to represent and has a ton of good music on it. And obviously, I liked that then and still do. But no, this was one that was, older brothers of friends. And I just didn't think I got it. You know, it seemed to be a coming of age movie before I had come of age. So it didn't click. And maybe I was always expecting more to click. And maybe it's kind of what you were getting at, that it's less the specifics that you're supposed to relate to and more the abstractions. Mm-hmm. And as you get older, that's what persists. You don't remember the specifics of what you did every night in high school, but you remember what it felt like. And I think maybe I was looking to connect with more of the specifics, and that's where it kind of missed for me.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. And also, like... at the age, well, certainly at the age when you would have seen it, it's not like you were watching a lot of movies that kind of didn't have plot, yeah. You know? And by the time I saw it, I kind of had slightly more experience with it, but still my appreciation of this movie, unsurprisingly, lines up perfectly with my growing appreciation of abstraction and cinema, you know? And specifically the Linklatery type of just not having a plot and just sort of being a quote-unquote slice of life sort of thing. So that also makes sense, especially since, you know, the movie, like when you sit down to watch this movie, you're like, okay, teen comedy. When you think of a teen comedy, especially around the time when you would have seen it for the first time, the teen comedy was a very, like, plot-heavy sort of thing. It was like, the plot was, like, sort of light, but it was like, we have this scene at school, then we have this party, and then we have this graduation scene, and then
we've all made a pact, or we have to obtain this MacGuffin, or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. And this just doesn't have, I mean, it kind of has the MacGuffin in the pledge sheet that that Pink has, but
considering there's 2/3 of this movie that he's not in, that just has no chance of being an ultimate goal that's always on our minds.
Exactly. And like one of the things I thought about with this movie that I think really speaks to the sort of, like, I don't know, the wafting general nature of it, you know, as opposed to the actual firm, like, walking down a line, is that you kind of assume Pink is the main character when you're watching the movie. But I feel like in my mind, Mitch has always been the main character. But I also feel like you could make an argument for Wooderson or like 14 other people, you know, like just because, or Anthony Rapp's character, I think you can make an argument for him. And it's just, I think if you add up the screen time, I'm sure Pink wins, but it can't possibly be that big of a difference between him and almost anybody else in the main chunk of cast, you know?
I have to think it's Pink or Mitch and some other people in a distant second. Not insanely distant, but I feel like it's those two up front.
It's them up front, but I just think, like, I just don't think the second is distant, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that this movie wants you to... I mean, we start and end with Pink, but I think that this movie wants to kind of give credit to everybody and give everyone's high school experience, you know, a fair shrift.
Yeah, exactly. And it also does a good job of doing that through one of the things I love about this movie, and I've always loved about this movie. It's another thing I liked about Freaks and Geeks a lot, is that Pink is the sort of high school character that straddles the line between being the quote-unquote jock and the quote-unquote nerd, you know? And I feel like that sort of character is totally underrepresented in high school movies. Just somebody that is able to be on both sides of that fence, you know? Like, there's no... At least in my experience, there wasn't as clear of a line. It wasn't, like, one side and then one side. It was, like, one side, one side and then a lot in the middle, you know, and then pink was like directly in the middle. And I just think that that type of character is really underrepresented in these types of movies.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think the Mean Girls cafeteria scene, you know, you could do that at your high school, but there's so much crossover in that Venn diagram that there'd really be hard. It'd be hard to draw lines between everybody, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And like, yeah. as somebody that was way closer to nerd than jock, you know, I still took gym every year of my high school career. So I was just friends with athletic people because I was playing basketball with them every day. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And so with Dazed and Confused, do you think that, I mean, I guess this applies to both of them. I don't know if you want to talk about, let's talk about Everybody Wants Them for a bit first. I'm sure we'll get back to some specifics about Dazed and Confused. How do you feel about it as a sequel and as a movie?
As a spiritual sequel, I think it's fantastic. I hate the term spiritual sequel, but I think it works. Just because I don't like saying it more than anything. But and Everybody Wants Them, I think, is a very fun movie. I really enjoy it. It's like, I have some issues with it. Like everything just looks too clean in a way that like the cinematography is just like, I don't know, just so plastic. And I don't like it that much. And I mean, that's sort of a criticism of Linklater as a whole, and that he shot this movie digitally, which just sort of, turns up the volume on his cinematographer's problems. So that's always bugged me. And I don't love how every one of these college students looks like a fucking 40-year-old, but but other than that,
the mustaches don't help.
No, I know, and I know that like college athletes always look older than regular people their age, like just because they, you know, to excel in athletics at the age of 20, you have to have developed quicker than other people. You know, other people that play baseball, like it just gives you a huge upper hand. So, but that's something that has always bothered me, but I really enjoy the movie.
And do you feel that they are really similar?
I mean, yes, they are similar, but they're also different in ways that I really appreciate. The thing that I appreciated so much about Everybody Wants Some, when I saw it, was, and I don't really know exactly what I anticipated I'll just say plot of Everybody Wants Some to be, but I don't think I anticipated it being the 3 days of college that it takes up. I don't think I expected the very first 3 days of college. I think I sort of expected them to go to the end of college for some reason. And that's partially surely ignorance on my part, just because when I'm already so in the tank for a director, I just don't find out that much about their movie if I can avoid it. So I just probably never saw the trailer or whatever for this movie. So that was like a real pleasant surprise. It's just that the movie did not take place when I anticipated it, you know, and I think that really set a good tone for my appreciation of the movie. And yeah, also, and Finn is hilariously engaging. Yeah, you know? I think the guy Finn. That plays Finn is amazing. Not okay. Jake, the I don't know, the the average cock guy.
yes. Yeah. I mean, to talk about the time period that it does take place over, it's the first three, like, we get a few hours into the first day of college. That's not a time period that we necessarily always see either, right?
No, exactly. I mean, we get like 5 minutes into the first day of college. Like, we get, or sorry, 5 minutes into class, you know? And I really appreciated that before college actually sort of begins, the movie's basically over.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. What about you?
I think it feels pretty similar. I mean, obviously we have more of a lead in Everybody Wants Some than we do in Dazed and Confused. Mm-hmm. As we said, like, you can kind of call it two people, but even that doesn't really do it justice. Like, it's so much about the people on the periphery. And I mean, I think I wouldn't be the first to say that Linklater is very interested in what's in the periphery. From a script standpoint, you know, it's not about big moments and big decisions and obvious high drama situations, but just, you know, the day-to-day of everybody's life. I still don't love either of these movies. Mm-hmm. I can't. Like, I've tried with Dazed and Confused so many times, and I think maybe I am still stuck in the first few times seeing it, kind of expecting more, not getting it. And now the more that is there is the less that is there. And I still think I'm still stuck in this like permanent underwhelmed nature of yep. watching these movies. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've talked about this with different movies, that the time that you've seen a movie for the first time or your formative experiences with it shape things kind of forever. And there are things that I do like more about it, and there's positive opinions I read about Dazed and Confused that intellectually I can agree with, but sitting through this movie is still kind of a chore for me for large portions of it. And
for Dazed and Confused?
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. Anyway, continue. No,
I know, and I don't even talk about this movie in public for that very reason.
It's just like such a breezy watch. It's like a tight 97, you know, like then when the credits hit.
Nothing about it's tight though.
Well, yeah.
That's I think that's what it is. Like I get that it breezes over, and I get that it never like I'm supposed to enjoy that it never really engages me. Mm-hmm. Well, not never, but rarely engages me. Mm-hmm. And I still just can't bring myself to that point to do it. And I kind of felt like I had a fresh start with Everybody Wants Some, because now I am someone who is more happy to watch a movie where very little happens and kind of enjoy the atmosphere and enjoy characters over, you know, A happens, which causes B, which causes C, which causes D, which heightens things for E, and then it all resolves in F. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of looking forward to Everybody Wants Something, and I still just didn't feel engaged in any meaningful way. And they kind of pushed all their chips into the middle with the one character, and I don't find that character very compelling at all.
Well, yeah, and he sucks.
Yeah, so why isn't that a problem for you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a problem, because he sucks. And he's also in The Edge of 17, which is a good movie with a lot of really good performances, and he sucks in that. He's just, I don't know, there's just something about him that's just so unlikable. But I don't know. I think it's just sort of the, basically every other performer in the movie is fantastic. So so I'm okay with it. You know, I like, it's just sort of the, I wish he had been played by a better, Jake had been played by a better actor, but, you know, you can't get everything you want out of life.
It's not just that he's handsome, right? That's not why we hate him.
No, no. Because okay. Finn's handsome. I love Finn.
Yeah, but he's like best friend, so it's different.
Whatever. However you have to describe this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like Wyatt Russell, I think, is really good. Willoughby.
Yes, of course.
And I will say, like, on the topic of this movie specifically, the first baseball practice, I think, is the best scene in this whole movie.
Oh, yeah, I would agree.
Okay, so what works there that is absent that from the rest of this movie that I can't get? And it's not to say that I disliked every second of this movie, because that's not true at all. But what do I get from that I'm missing from almost the rest of this movie?
Structure.
But what's the structure?
The structure is stretching, batting practice, scrimmage.
Practice over.
Yeah.
Like baseball, I understand the rules. I don't understand the rules of the dating game party thing.
Yeah. Well, okay, so the way you're describing your lack of appreciation for Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some, is just another sort of version of, I think, every conversation about a Linklater movie we've ever had. And I just sort of think that, like, my perception of your feelings on Richard Linklater is that you get it and it's just not for you. And I get that, you know, because, like, I think of all the directors that I like as much as I like Richard Linklater's, I think, or work as much as I like of Linklater's, I think Linklater's problems are the most glaring. But the things that I like, I just like enough that I don't care about those things. Like that, the cardboard cutout plastic cinematography that I talked about, that would bother me if everything else about the movie wasn't good, or Jake's performance. That would bother me if everything else about the movie wasn't as good as it is. And I do sort of feel like the baseball practice sort of is something that you like because it. That is structure in a very mild sense, what I described, but but all it is sort of a version of a scene that you've seen before. You know, it's just sort of like it's the team practicing montage, but it just takes a sort of Linklater return, and that you actually get some fun conversations in it. The pitching matchup between Raw Dogg, is his name Niles?
Yeah.
It's
who I love.
He's pretty great.
It's so funny. He's throwing a baseball away into a fucking parking lot, to quote him perfectly.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful.
Him yelling, "Check your pillows," might be my favorite line in the whole movie. Like, that line's unbelievable.
Like, I know he gets to be the loudest and the biggest and the funniest, which are things that I like when done properly, but there's something good about him too.
Oh yeah,
and I like Willoughby, and he doesn't do those things. But
I mean, there's so many good performances in the team. I mentioned Finn. I think Mac is fantastic in this movie. The thing I like so much about that pitching matchup is Mac sort of like asserting himself as the authority figure of the team and of this movie, but in such a way where it's just like I'm one of you, but also when I have to, I'm going to teach you a lesson, and also when you sort of learn your lesson, it's just going to be I'm just going to pat you on the chest and say we're good, and then we move on, you know. That all of that is like fantastic, and I just love the way that Mac is both so present in this movie and also totally absent through large portions of the movie. I don't know, we'll talk about that later, I'm sure, but I think that actor's good, the Teen Wolf guy. And Nez might be my favorite in the movie. He's so good. But no, I do think that baseball practice, just there is an element of structure to that, just in the sort of training montage that we are used to, that just doesn't exist throughout the rest of the movie, you know?
Yeah, and it's the most outright confrontation we see. Like, this is all one team. It's all the same people that we've seen in a movie full of competition, which this movie is happy to point out at one point, they compete so much. thanks. But yeah, that kind of is the, like, it doesn't even have to be necessarily butting heads in a confrontational way, but we are kind of seeing personalities collide. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be purely negative. Like, I don't think I would have needed that scene to break into a fight or even be as confrontational as it was, but that is kind of these, you know, floating atoms colliding in a very real way that is kind of absent from the rest of this movie.
Yeah, and even like that's the scene where, or sorry, in the scene after, where you actually see some sort of like character development where you know, you get Buter starting to join the conversation when they're at Wigwam or whatever that place is called, eating after practice. You sort of get him, who has been so absent from any sort of team mentality, like you see him moving along and sort of feeling like a part of the team. And all of the freshmen, you can see them having some sort of character development, which by the standards of a Linklater movie is like, is just pretty unbelievable that there's any development, you know? And
that's sweep weeks in the Linklater universe.
Exactly. Yeah. That's Brad Pitt guest starring on Friends in Linklater's world. And I just think that it's the scene that's the most like a non-Linklater movie, and I just think you will just never be a Linklater person, despite, again, and I don't mean this as an insult, I just think that through conversations that we've had over maybe like 10 years now, that just might be a truth about you, you know?
I liked him so much when we saw him, though, but he is the physical embodiment of all his movies.
Oh, for sure. And even like when we saw him, he was introducing a screening of The Last Emperor, and talked about basically everything but The Last Emperor for 30 minutes. And then at the very end said he hadn't seen the movie in 30 years. Now let's watch The Last Emperor, more or less. So that, you're right, that is a perfect encapsulation of his movies. He's just going to talk about everything except the thing you are there to see.
The other scene that I can think of, and everybody wants some of, you know, any sort of collision or characters bouncing off each other in a real way, is his phone call with the auburn haired girl. Mm-hmm. Which I would thought was completely like insufferable.
He had a quick chat with Beverly.
I mean, maybe it's just because I didn't care about him, but I was so uninvested in that phone call.
Yeah, I get that. She's great, he's not, so I can totally see it.
Yeah, she's it, fine.
It's so many things in Linklater movies rely on liking the people playing them. That's why he keeps casting Ethan Hawke over and over again, because Ethan Hawke is perfect to read Linklater dialogue. And he's just not, so it just can't work. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the split screen is a weird visual choice. And
yeah, and also it's pretty clear they didn't plan on doing a split screen. So that sort of jumps out. Like the way that the camera moves in her shots and Beverly's shots, it's just sort of, it really, really indicates to me that they planned on cutting between the two and just sort of found in editing that it wasn't working and tried to Mean Girls it up.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that brings me to another question about his visual style that, you know, I want to ask you about with both of these movies, but you said it was too clean. That seems really antithetical to his style, though. Shouldn't it be very, like, I mean, a lot of it is low-key in a way of, you know, not a lot of camera movement and things like that, but, although there definitely is some examples. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't he have, like, dirty frames and very low-key visuals and, you know, the way that Everybody Wants Some is so digital and clean? Doesn't that seem out of the vision he tries to present about the stories he tells?
Yeah, a little bit. And that's just sort of why I think shooting digital for this movie just was a really bad option, because, like, to me, film just as a physical thing, it just sort of naturally feels a little bit more dirty. And even if you just look at Boyhood, his previous film, again, not the most inventively shot film, but it just looks better because it's shot on film and it's something that's sort of lived in, like the world that Linklater is trying to present to us. Whereas this looks a little bit too much like it was trying to emulate Porky's visually or something, you know, and it's just like a bad version of that. And so, yeah, the cinematography in this movie is like almost could be described as bad, you know? And so, yeah, it bothers me. But again, the good outweighs the bad.
And what about Dazed and Confused?
Oh, it's fine. It's just sort of like, it's very plain. But it's
which is what his should be, you feel?
I think it's fine. I just don't think he cares about set design at all. You know?
Right.
I think he is very much one of those directors where it's like, he sort of assumes everybody is going to see his movies for the script, which is true of way more people than way more directors than actually think that. And I think Linklater is just like, I'm here for the script. The people are here for the script. Set design, I care about a little bit, but not too much. You know, like, as I don't know, some things interrupt the flow of the movie too much for him to care about. I think he's one of those guys that would care a lot about the flow of a set.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Which is sort of like, I mean, we mentioned Nolan earlier, like he just does a lot of boring handheld cinematography because he likes to move quickly, you know? And I think and that's sort of, is like his stylistic downfall is that he doesn't have like cinema grammar in a lot of his scenes. And I think a lot of directors sort of see their own flaws and are willing to keep it moving if only because of the thing their flaw allows them to maintain, and that Richard Linklater doesn't have to think about set design. So he can just sort of think about sitting and thinking for a bit, you know, making his characters sit and think and talk for a bit.
Yeah. And focusing on his strengths.
Yeah. Like shots of joints being rolled.
Or bongs being packed, yeah, or exactly. Pipes being packed. You might notice a theme here.
Yeah. Guys, Richard Linklater might like weed.
Guys, Richard Linklater might be weed. do you think these movies over-idealize teenage years and college years?
I don't feel that way. I can easily see an argument for it. But I do really get the feeling, I don't know. I just always feel like watching these movies, like I'm watching time progress. And despite the fact that they are both the product of a man wanting to go back in time. And especially in the case of Everybody Wants Him, I think Willoughby's a real stand in for Linklater. And just him commenting on himself, just like Wooderson is in a lesser extent in Dazed and Confused. I think Linklater knows that he's kind of just, he feels just this desire to want to go back, and that might be weird. Well, it's definitely weird to maybe focus like a year of your life on thinking about your high school career or your college career. And I think he's conscious of that, but there's something about the way that time passes in these movies that doesn't idealize them too much for me. You know, like, I don't know. There's some indescribable realness to it to me that I just I don't know. I can't describe. Indescribable.
Yeah. 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 I mean, Dazed and Confused. I mean, the movie I'm more familiar with, despite seeing Everybody Wants Them more recently. Oh, Everybody Wants Them. It shows, I think, plenty of negativity. Like, it shows apprehension, and even our, even Pink, you know, not huge problems, but is still dealing with something and is still unsure and is questioning decisions and feels kind of pigeonholed in a way. And I think that it's interesting that he is the character we've said is good at, you know, navigating from, you know, group to group and occupies a few different spaces simultaneously. But there is uneasiness for all of these characters. You know, I think that even the people who look to be having the most fun are definitely struggling with certain things throughout the movie. So I don't know that it's a total breeze. I mean, I can see people liking this movie for, you know, I think part of why people like this movie and why, you know, it's kind of like an older brother showing a younger brother thing is it does show like these really great times that happened in high school. I think it also shows the 70s in this really fun way of, you know, the music and the cars and weed and all that. But it's, I don't think it's completely rose colored glasses either.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, you get the scene where Adam Goldberg fights Nikki Catt. And I think Adam Goldberg's performance at the end of that fight really is kind of exactly what you're talking about. Like, he's just so emotionally sort of, I mean, he's been punched a few times, but he's also very emotionally beaten up as well. And, you know, nobody in this movie is having fun all the time. And I mean, except for maybe Wooderson. but even he has to break up a fight, which I'm sure he didn't love doing because it involved moving quickly. But yeah, like nobody's having fun all the time. Even Pink at the end, like he's totally in the middle of with that pledge sheet, right? He says, "I might play ball, but I'll never sign that." You know, like he's still keeping the possibility of football open because I find it hard to believe the team wouldn't take back their starting quarterback if he decides to play. I think that's just sort of how it works. But he, I don't know, like there's still some sort of emotional quandary that he's going through at the end of the movie that just never gets resolved. You know, just goes to see Aerosmith.
Yeah. And I mean, we've got Wooderson and O'Banion in Dazed and Confused, and we have Willoughby as these examples of people trying to function outside of like this temporal time frame, I guess. Mm-hmm. What do these movies say about those guys? And I mean, you've kind of already mentioned that they stand in for Linklater, but he's clearly, that's a negative. Like you've kind of posited that in a negative way, right? Like it's ridiculous to spend time, this much time, focusing on your past and, you know, steering your creative career about focusing on something behind. And within those products, he makes these guys, you know, to look pretty bad, I guess. Like, what does that say about people trying to function outside of the, like, that window that is kind of closed on them?
Yeah, like being the person who graduated from high school a year ago but is still going to high school parties, basically. I think it's sort of like, I think Dazed and Confused is the better example to talk about this with, just because he is closer to the high school age when he's making Dazed and Confused. And it is a sort of yin yang sort of situation where you get O'Banion, who's such a jerk, according to Mitch, and Wooderson, who's just treated like, I mean, everybody, Wooderson's just like that guy that everybody likes, you know? So it's just like, he can still be here even though he's a perv, just because he's Matthew McConaughey levels of charming. So yeah, I think it just sort of says that, but there is something, there is just a persistent weirdness about Wooderson, even despite the fact that everybody likes him. It's just the fact that he is there is still kind of weird. And I don't think it comments on it. Specifically, I just sort of think it points out that it happens and lets you make up your own mind about it. Yeah. You know?
Okay.
Linklater's not making you sign a pledge sheet about how to feel about Wooderson.
No, even though he uses it for positivity and he never gets his comeuppance or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Wooderson's comeuppance is, I guess, driving drunk to go buy tickets to Aerosmith.
Yeah, or statutory rape charges in a hypothetical future.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's not overlook that.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of, in both of these movies, there's lots of very questionable behavior, which, like, Dawn is a good example of somebody who, like, that's a really good example of Linklater. He's the overalls guy. A character that Linklater is kind of the only person that would do, whereas he's sexually harassing people constantly, but he is he's never vilified. And I think the idea that we are supposed to get out of that is that he is a 17-18 year old football player who is an idiot, and it's the 70s, and it's it would be kind of like a dishonest portrait of Linklater's time in high school to not include somebody that was doing that. And also, when you think about being in high school, all the things that are like acts of villainy that are not specifically vilified by you and your friends, like it just is more real to me to have a character that's doing all this gross shit without necessarily being O'Banion, you know, being an obvious villain who everybody hates. Well, with the exception of Pink, who mentions enjoying having a block for him. And I think the example of that, and Everybody Wants Some, that I really enjoy, is the use of the F word, and not fuck. I'm talking about the F word that I won't say on this podcast. And it's used very early on, and it's not used by one of our main characters. It's like when the guys are driving around harassing women, they're yelling at some women on their porch, and they yell back, call them the F word. And I think by like that sort of is just a way of being like, if this movie taking place in college in 1980, if nobody used that slur, it would be dishonest. And I think the way that Linklater sort of navigates that without anybody really being vilified, and also you not feeling like it's Tarantino using the N-word sort of thing. I don't know, because nobody ever feels like Richard Linklater is homophobic, despite the fact that characters in his movies say homophobic things, you know? And I think the fact that he's able to sort of address these elements of the time period without making the people that do these things necessarily awful, without people learning a lesson, I think that's something that's unique about him.
Yeah, and I think the Tarantino thing was the number of times a character said it, and that character was played by him in one very...
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. But also, I'm not talking necessarily the Phil Lamar's corpse in Pulp Fiction, necessarily. I'm just talking his movies in general, you know?
Right, yeah.
Anyway, we don't really want to rehash that.
No, but I think it's important that is what you said, of that it's this representation of time, which is so like it's this representation of this time period, of this decade, and the idea that the passage of time and time periods in that same sense are so essential to what this director does, and having these characters kind of try to stray from their time frame. And even just, we always get the hazing rituals. The hazing rituals are so important to both of these movies. Yeah. It's just this idea that you can be whoever you are, and everyone has these different personalities and these different roles within these groups, but there is just this hierarchy based on seniority that is an essential part of your identity, no matter how you act or where you come from. But there is this temporality equaling identity thing that can't be escaped, and it's talked about in both movies, and you just, you know, whichever speech you want to take, you know, you take your lumps and you move on or whatever. It's just that's it's so quintessential to who he is.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, to go back to what I was saying about the slur, like it's used so early on so that they don't have to, because there's no way that baseball team isn't dropping F-bombs all over the place. It's a college baseball team in 1980. There's no way there are not a lot of gay slurs being thrown about. And I just sort of think, like, by addressing it right off the bat, he's able to get past not using it for the rest of the movie. Something that I would compare that to in another one of his movies is we've talked about on the Boyhood podcast, when Mason is shown a picture of a mini pig or whatever while he's driving. Like any other movie, we see Mason then crash the car. Like that's the lesson that movies have taught us. It's like you text and drive, you look at a photo of a mini pig and drive, and then you crash your car. But people text and drive and don't crash their car sometimes. You know, these things happen, just like people drive drunk in Texas and don't crash their car, which is another thing that happens constantly in these movies. And I just think that that is something that Linklater is able to remove himself from film conventions in order to sort of show an element of life that is not discussed in film and not really discussed in Linklater movies, but will at least be shown. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
For all his flowing, meandering, you know, slice of life, whatever other synonyms you want to apply to his style of filmmaking, I think you get the point. Are things ever, like, way too on the nose for you, or is that just me?
Again, yes and no. Like, yeah, way too on the nose in a way that I just sort of find charming. And, like, so I generally, like, view Richard Linklater as somebody that I think he got to, like, 25 one day, got too high, and then just stopped growing. You know, like, just sort of mentally... But I do think he's like the best case scenario of that sort of stone 25-year-old thinking about life. And it's, again, like, this is not our most eloquent podcast because he's so difficult to talk about, because what he is able to do is so uncommon in American film, because, I don't know, there's just like a feeling to a Linklater movie that just does not exist in any other movie. But yes, some things are too on the nose, just like sitting around when you're high and 25 and talking about whatever you're talking about when you're high and 25 is a little too on the nose. I do concur with that thought, but I think the pluses vastly outweigh the minuses to me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just need you to accept.
Like
it.
I accept it. What are some of these things that you're talking about?
Frontiers are where you find them in bold upper caps on the chalkboard at the end of Everybody Wants Them. As I already said, talking about how often these, the competition's ongoing and Everybody Wants Some. Something can always be learned from these little games. It makes you question who you really are at the punk bar. I don't know. I always just feel like the way people talk about him is that there's never these big moments. There's never something you can point to where he's trying to be deep. Like, it's always, you know, just these tableaus of existence, and you can plug in your own ideas and your own notions, but it all comes within you. And, like, this is this blank canvas for you to put on your own experiences and your own thoughts. But I find that there's at least six times a movie that's not true, and it's not true in this really noticeable way.
Yep. I don't disagree.
Okay. Yeah, it just seems so against what he's trying to do the most of the time, and what we talk about when we talk about his style, that seems to be excised from it. And I don't think that's fair. People talk about these movies achieving so much by saying so little, but they hammer some things hard, and I guess everybody looks at it the same way you do, that he does so much else right, or that because there's no kind of narrative structure to those things, that we don't think of these as forcing an idea down our throat, or because there's no, you know, imperative in the plot line that X, Y, and Z need to happen, that everything about these movies are abstract and up to interpretation. But I just don't find that true.
No, I agree. I think what he does is make movies that are that are like very close to Hollywood movies, but just in a tone that is totally absent from Hollywood. So that I think people just sort of get caught up in the tone and are able to skip over the or miss the parts where it does sort of get very Hollywoody, a very somebody explaining something a little bit too much sort of thing. I don't know. I think never underestimate the power of a consistent tone, consistent cinematic tone.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I appreciate very much about his filmmaking in general, is that if I just sort of want to, I don't know, like not feel like I'm being, like I'm wasting my brain space, but also not wanting to watch something too emotionally shattering, like a Linklater movie's kind of perfect. You know, it's just very middle. It's very, I'm going to exist for 97 minutes in the case of Dazed and Confused, or an hour and 57 minutes in the case of Everybody Wants Some, and just sort of, I don't know, I might think about a couple things that are present in the movie. I might be annoyed by a couple things that are present in the movie. I know I'm going to laugh, and I know I'm going to see some very engaging performances. And I don't know, I think it's some combination of all of those things that creates the Linklater ethos, and I think you're able to skim over some of those parts if you like the specifically Linklaterian moments as much as I do.
Because it's a good hang.
It's a good hang.
And none of these movies pass the Michael Bay let's cut a scene if anyone gets up to go to the washroom during a focus group test.
I mean, I think one of the lessons of this movie is just go to the washroom where you physically are currently. So I think there's just a lot of people pissing in the theater in the test screenings.
He's so chill like that. Just lets you piss anywhere.
Yeah, he'll just walk around handing out the National Beer of Texas at the beginning of the screening and just anticipate you getting up and pissing in the corner of the theater.
Hey, shout out to the Lone Star. Everybody wants them.
Yeah, if Lone Star wants to send us a case of Lone Star, we would deeply appreciate it. We will plug them on every podcast for the rest of our existence.
Can I ask you another Dazed and Confused question?
Of course.
So we get a
discussion. We have like four more hours before we're done here.
Oh boy. Okay, let me say some really obviously poignant things, and yeah, then we'll meander through another 40 minutes of conversation.
Talk about how it feels to be almost turning 30 in very obvious ways.
Yeah. Okay, actually I have two questions. Cool. One is the initial foosball shot of the ball being put into the table. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Hot shot.
How do they do that?
I think it
is... a foosball table in half?
I think that's the most likely example, because the way that jumped to my mind initially was they built a giant foosball table, which I think is the other option, just because it looks so large. And
that doesn't seem very Linklater, though.
No, exactly. It doesn't. And it's so much effort for one shot. And maybe it's something they actually did put a lot of effort into, and Linklater was like, never again. this is not worth it for this one foosball table shot. But yes, fantastic shot. And I think the way they would have done it is either cut a foosball table in half and use a long lens, or build a larger than life foosball table and shoot it.
Yeah, that was really cool. And just so jarring in a movie that does not have shots like that.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Another Dazed and Confused question.
Cool.
We get a discussion of the decades, and the 60s ruled, and the 70s suck, and the 80s are going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it broke down, right?
I mean, of those three decades, I was alive for 4 years.
But I mean, this movie was alive for, like, you were four and this movie came, or not four, but...
I was negative 10. Sorry, I guess I was 7 when this movie came out, negative 10 when it was set.
Yeah, exactly. Which is another funny thing about him, we did touch a bit, but about him making these movies about people stuck in, like, certain times. Like, he's 20 years late on one of these movies, and... even more late on the second one.
Yeah, for sure.
But isn't historical memory like somehow the 60s and 70s were both awesome and then the 80s sucked? Or am I wrong in that?
I think, yes, I think you're right about the 80s. I think the 70s to a rock, I think what that character, it's Marissa Ribisi's character that's talking about it, right?
Yeah.
I think what she is sort of meaning is that what she's basically talking about is disco sucks, I think is what's happening there. And like when you think about the concerns of such a youthful character, somebody who's 17 or 18, you sort of think about these very, very minute concerns, all things considered. And I think that's sort of what she's thinking of, is that I think that is meant to encapsulate sort of the rise of disco and disco sex.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. And I think that people, I've heard it, like the good things about the 60s were just things, or the good things about the 70s were just things that were left over from the 60s. Like, yeah. It wasn't things sprung organically from the 70s. It was holdovers from the 60s. And then we got disco and a lot of like corporate things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but because I just think that the 70s are still looked at really fondly overall. Like there is that disco thing, but people were kind of, maybe people have just done a really good job of compartmentalizing and like suppressing the memories of disco. But I think that's part of why this was such a nostalgia movie for people who weren't even alive in the period that it's glorifying, is mm-hmm. that there was, like, as we talked about, the cars and the music and the weed and the, like, still kind of some Summer of Love hangover. I think the 70s are still pretty idealized overall.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say overall for sure. I will also say we are talking about this movie 24 years after Dazed and Confused was released. So maybe in 1993 they weren't quite as idealized, being closer to the actual decade. But I do think what you're right is, or what you're saying, holdovers from the 60s are the things we loved about the 70s. I think that's correct. And I think, I mean, for me, the 70s in filmmaking is my favorite decade, or in American filmmaking is my favorite decade, but it is explicitly holdovers from the 60s that make it that way. You know, it's the revolution that The Graduate started, or The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde started, that just sort of carried on through most of the 70s.
Yeah,
until Jaws exploded.
When a soon-to-be mother can still buy cigarettes and whiskey and no one bats an eye.
Oh my god. Those are the days. We haven't talked about Wiley Wiggins in this movie. And
well,
how
I know.
He is simultaneously so bad.
The worst?
Oh, he's so good. Like, I don't know, man. It's so difficult to... I think he kind of perfectly sums up the feel of a Linklater movie, in that, I mean, I don't think he's ever been in a non-Linklater movie. I think that sort of explains how he fits so well in this movie and Waking Life, and I think like no other movies. But I don't know, he's just simultaneously perfect despite like having glaring problems, you know? And that's kind of how I feel about Linklater movies. They are both perfect and have glaring problems, you know?
Yeah, he straddles a few lines.
Oh, he's so good.
His androgyny, his constant nose pinching,
yeah,
and sometimes good performing.
Yeah. Well, it's also extra funny now watching it, now that he looks like the fourth member of Haim. It's, I don't know, that just adds an extra element of hilarity to it in 2017.
Yeah, what's the difference between Pink and Mitch Kramer, if we're going to talk about those guys as our main characters? Is that just a matter of time passing, or are those fundamentally different characters, and like why?
I think it's more a matter of time passing, and because it seems like Mitch is a good pitcher. It seems like he excels at the sport that he plays. In Texas, the high school quarterback is always going to be the top of the food chain, as far as movies have taught me. But there is sort of that athletic element to Mitch. But also, just by the virtue of being 13 or however old he is, you're still a fucking nerd. You know, just because you're... even the cool 13-year-olds are absolute nerds, you know? And I think that that's just sort of... I think it's very easy to imagine Pink 3 years previous being just like Mitch, you know?
Yeah.
Which fair. Is something that the movie, one nice thing I will say about Linklater's visual style, shows us in that frame when Mitch and Pink get to, I think it's the Emporium, and run into Mitch's sister and the younger girl that Mitch's sister has brought. There's this framing that shows Pink and Mitch's sister in the background, and then Mitch and the other younger girl whose name escapes me standing exactly the same way in the foreground. And I think that's just exactly how we're supposed to see them. It's that they're the same people, just 3 years younger.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a good shot.
Yeah.
And I guess, are we meant to take away anything from these movies, or is it just that like that good hang, the atmosphere and kind of food for thought? Because I think about Dazed and Confused, and we have Pink. I mean, if there's any big conundrum in this movie, it's whether he signs the sheet, right? Whether he signs the pledge.
Yeah.
And he's told not to hang out with these people, and he chooses to anyway. And it culminates, as much as any of these movies do, with him smoking weed at the 50-yard line, right? And they're Wooderson goes to get papers, you know, the most stony macaroni thing, and he's still running routes, right? Like, it's still this synthesis of the two lifestyles that this movie's kind of compare, you know, the star athlete and the burnout, I guess, to put it pejoratively. Does this movie ever kind of take a stance on that? You know, I think the big closer is, the older you get, the more rules they're going to try to get you to follow. And he rejects that as an idea. Is he choosing a side of that, or is he kind of excluding himself from that dichotomy as a whole?
I mean, I think the phrase, the older you get, the more rules they're going to try to make you follow, is something that Linklater probably firmly believes. I will also
which is why he stopped getting older at 25.
Yeah. I will also say, I mean, realizing the realities of age, you know, if he's not middle-aged, he's almost middle-aged. But a middle-aged film director is a perfect example of somebody who did not follow any of the rules that people set out for you when you're 19 or 20. Just in that it's such a bizarre lifestyle, you know, like, you work really, really hard for a year and then maybe don't work for 6 months, you know? And it's just such a bizarre lifestyle. And I don't know, I think Linklater's sort of commenting on regular people's lives that he will never actually experience, just because he's been a director since he was so young. But I think the way that the movie, I think that the main thing that the movie wants us to think is just sort of the treatment of the authority figures more than the actual words that are being said, like what you're saying about rules being followed. Because I think Dazed and Confused has a pretty hard theme of authority. You know, and the coach trying to get him to sign the paper, the pledge sheet. The bicentennial is mentioned all the time. Like, what's more authoritarian than the people that founded the country?
Yeah, it's a bunch of aristocratic white males who didn't want to pay their taxes.
Exactly. And Mitch, when he goes to get when he gets hazed by O'Banion and all them, he walks past a happy bicentennial sign. There's also the whole community turning a blind eye to the hazing. Just these figures of authority just doing these things that are
so awful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, or at least not looking at them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And and just the way that Pink has to interact with his coach throughout the movie a couple times. I think what the contrast to that in Everybody Wants Some is that, as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, Pink and Wooderson and Joey Lauren Adams just drive out of Dazed and Confused, and then we drive into Jake's new home. It should also be mentioned that Everybody Wants Some takes place in 1980, which would be the year that Mitch goes to college, you know, which I think is another nice little spiritual sequel moment. But Jake immediately walks into this house. This is his new place of living, and there is no authority, you know, none whatsoever. Yeah. And I think the thing that is the most interesting about Everybody Wants Some is how the film is almost entirely devoid of authority figures. You get two scenes with the coach, but it also is very clear that Mac is the person that is the leader. And you don't get anybody else until the very end with the teacher, who doesn't even say anything. But I just sort of feel like, I remember the first time I was watching this movie in theaters, I was just sort of sitting there being like, what is this movie? You know, like, the last 20 minutes, it's just sort of just keeps going. It's just a very Linklater-y movie, even more so than most of them. And then somebody comes in and writes the meaning of the movie on the whiteboard or the blackboard, I don't remember which one.
Blackboard, for the record.
Okay. And which is obviously something that would annoy me. But I think the fact that the teacher never talks, and also that Jake immediately falls asleep, right? And I think that's sort of like an interesting way of sort of showing where Linklater is coming at for these movies. I think, you know, we mentioned Wooderson, Willoughby, and O'Banion as sort of stand-ins for characters that refuse to move on. I think the silent stand-in for Linklater is that the professor at the end. And what the professor is trying to teach the kids is that frontiers are where you find them, but the kid is going to go to sleep as soon as you try and tell him what to think. And I think that's the main thing about both of these movies, is that what they both show us is a piece of life of people trying to tell them what to think. But the thing is, you can't learn any of these lessons until you actually physically experience them yourself. And I think that's really cool. I love the way the sound drops out in the Frontiers Are Where You Find Them scene. I think that just sort of shows how Jake is tuning out everything but his own world, and I just think that's really interesting. And I think the older you get, the more rules they are going to try and get you to follow. But I don't know, you have to make those decisions for yourself, you know, is what this movie is trying to teach you. Even the bitch stick scene, you can't lean on something else for help, you know, it's just you now. Yeah. So
absolutely,
I think that is like a long-winded, very meandering answer to your barely answer to your question, but I think Linklater would be very proud of how meandering yes, it was.
Very, very appropriate.
So Frontiers Are Where You Find Them, but you already fell asleep, so you can't learn the lesson. Yeah.
Be well. So do you want to say all right, all right, all right, or you just want to end the episode?
I just want to just keep living, yeah. I just want to go on SNL and do that monologue about all that dumb shit. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Blade Runner 2049.